Can't have someone just managing a portfolio that's best friends with everyone. That's not impactful for anyone.
Welcome everyone back to another episode of Shares Not Shoes, an insider's guide to careers in finance. I'm your host, Camilla Love, founder of F3, Future Females in Finance. Shares Not Shoes is a podcast whereby I interview some of my favorite people, all with one thing in common. They work in finance. We lift the lid on who they are, how they came into a career in finance, and arm you with some knowledge about why a career in finance could be a good fit for you. I will promise that all my guests will share some amazing personal stories, will be open and honest, and will inspire you. So, let's go. Today's guest has a job that I would love one day. From a humble business development background like my own to having her own startup to today becoming a partner at one of the big four, this woman has done it all. She's an advisor, coach, and investor in the VC space. She structured deals, scaled up businesses, and now supports startups with the knowledge that she has garnered to make them overly successful. Welcome to the podcast, Amanda Price.
Hi, thank you.
Thanks so much for joining us on Shares Not Shoes, and thanks for helping our listeners find out a little bit more about the startup venture capital space, and particularly about structuring deals for success and actually even supporting startups to scale up and how really not to make mistakes in this segment. So, Amanda, you are, as I mentioned, the partner at KPMG High Growth Ventures, and you support startups with scaling their businesses. Tell me a little bit about your day-to-day job and why you jump out of bed every day to do it.
I do jump out of bed every morning. Well, we're very lucky. So we, as you said, it is a great job and sort of unusual job in that we do get to work with a lot of startups each day. So typically it is meeting with different startups and really trying to assess if there's ways that we can help them and support them. And the way that we do that is typically we work with quite early stage companies at the beginning, and we like to be there for the whole journey if we can. And it's really looking initially at the foundation, so how they're set up for growth. So really it's having conversations with founders, understanding their businesses, understanding their plans for growth. And yeah, as I said, just looking at if there's services that we have that can support them.
Great. So you had your own startup and scaled it up and now advises businesses, as I mentioned, in this growth journey. Can you tell me about a mistake that you made as an entrepreneur? And there's probably many of them. And ensure that your businesses that you advise today just don't do or don't make that same mistake?
Yeah, I mean, look, there's so obviously so many. The whole podcast would be about all the mistakes that I've made. But look, I think the area I'm particularly passionate about is the foundations, because it's the area that I made quite a few mistakes in. And I think what I've come to learn is if things aren't set up from the beginning in the right way, that just causes so much pain later on. And that can be, you know, little things in terms of just even systems like CRM and getting your basic system set up so you can track the business in the best way. And it can be things around finance, you know, making sure the finance function is set up and the reporting is set up in the right way. And tax and structuring is a big one, making sure the business is set up properly, and also things around agreements with other founders on who owns what. I think all of those things become really, they seem important at the beginning, but they're super, super important as you start to grow. So if you get that wrong, it's very expensive and hard to unwind. So I would say, you know, the big lessons are just taking the time to get things set up properly at the beginning. Even though at that stage you might think, oh, the business doesn't earn much money and it's, I don't know if it's going to go ahead, it's still worth the time just to think that through.
Yeah, and that's so true when, you know, inevitably there is some sort of catalyst event halfway through your growth journey that enables you to fall back onto those, you know, strong foundations. And generally as a startup and an entrepreneur, you're pedaling fast just to get your concept out there and your ideas and all that sort of stuff, but really do forget those foundations. But so that's a great mistake to ensure that no one
yes.
makes. And I'm assuming that
no one makes it. Yeah.
And I'm assuming that KPMG, because of, you know, all their intellect internally and all their, you know, all the different skill sets that the partners have and the teams have, they support your ecosystem in building those foundations?
Yeah, they do. They do. And what we've done is, I mean, when I joined KPMG, I had an idea. The idea was high growth ventures. So I pitched the idea, but I really didn't have any understanding of what KPMG did, to be quite honest. I knew some of the key services and I thought, oh, well, they finance. Well, that's really good for startups. Audits, they'll need that as they grow. Different things. But there's just a huge range of services and not all of them are applicable to startups. And so what we've done over the years is we've worked out where the right expertise is in KPMG that is relevant to startups. And we've sort of standardized those offerings and priced them for startups. So yes, we access a lot of the expertise from KPMG, but in really specific areas, as I've said, around more the finance, compliance, risk, audit type services.
And so thinking about your skill set and where you've come from, what is it in that, you know, BD sales client side piece that really impacts the startup and the scale up of the businesses and the advice that you give today?
Yeah, I think it's interesting actually, because you know the services we sell, I don't have a lot of background in. I know they're so important, but I suppose for me, what I bring is a sales and marketing lens. And I think that's hugely important. I mean, when you're starting a startup, having some background in BD, because if that, you know, really it's going to be founder-led sales for most businesses for the first couple of years, if not longer. And so, yeah, I just think for me, it's working with those founders to look at, are they spending enough time in front of, like, where are they spending their time? Are they spending their time, enough time in front of clients? You know, what's sort of, how is the BD, how's the sales team structured? How are they looking at the sales data around conversions and pipeline and things like that? So I think for me, yeah, I definitely get that all of the other services are super important, but when you've got a startup, you've got to get sales in the door and you've got to do it as quickly as possible. So for me, it's working with those founders and really focusing on that sales piece.
Yeah. And also, like, I think as, you know, a BD person myself, the product market fit, really thinking about how that product market fit. Have you seen in your, you know, I'm sure you have, in the journey where the product market fit hasn't been right and so therefore they've had to pivot and find a different client set for the same product?
Yeah, often actually, more often than you think. I think, you know, you see that it either doesn't, they struggle to find the right audience, or they realize the audience isn't large enough, or the audience won't pay for what, the problem isn't actually acute enough that people will pay the amount that they need. And so I think that, you know, that the thing about being in a startup is the testing. I mean, it's constant experimentation and testing. And so in the beginning, you know, I think it's really important that you keep that curiosity and the mindset of experimentation. So you're out there really trying to find true market product fit. And I think that sometimes takes time. And often most startups will sort of vary from their original plan in some way. I even know with high growth ventures, it's taken us a few years. It took 3 to 4 years to really work out what services were of real value. You know, as I said before, what's the right expertise within KPMG to connect into startups then in a way that we can truly add value? And it just took a lot of experimentation. I think that's pretty normal in startups.
Yeah, and that, you know, the old adage of, you know, failing fast, I think that's particularly important at this juncture of product market fit, because you actually, you know, if it's not working, you run out of cash really fast if you keep pushing down that channel.
That's right. And that's what we said before about that BD lens, like coming in with a startup. You know, if you're going to be a founder of a startup, you've got to be out in front of market and really leading that testing. And you're right, at pace, because you want to fail as quickly as you can, or you know, experiment, have hypothesis and experiment. If that doesn't work, how are you going to change and keep moving? I think that's the fascinating thing about working with startups, really, is the sort of constant change, experimentation and testing. I mean, that's what's makes a startup, I think.
Yeah. And that's fun.
Yes.
That's the fun part.
That is the fun part. I mean, not when you're right in the middle of it sometimes.
True.
It's fun when you've done it and it works, but it is all part of it. I mean, that's definitely part of the startup journey. Otherwise, you sort of, like, often people say, what's the difference between an SME and a startup? And I think it's obviously the tech piece and the growth and the scale, but it's also that, I mean, you know, an SME doesn't go in and constantly small, medium enterprise doesn't go in constantly iterate. And that is the sort of fun part. And I think that is what draws a lot of us to the startups.
Yeah. And another thing, you know, I think about as an angel investor myself, the role of the founder, we've mentioned it a few times already, but the role of the founder, and as with an investor lens, you know, that alpha real salesperson founder versus the real technical specialist founder, and having that, not being sucked in by one or the other when you're an investor, is really interesting. Mm. And mm. And the biases that come in on that, what are your thoughts on that?
I think it's a really interesting sort of comment question, because it's funny, as a recent investor as well, it's certainly changed the way that I look at things. And I think you've really got to be careful not to fall into that traditional sort of thinking, haven't you, of seeing a confident, let's say, male salesperson and think that they're necessarily better than an engineer at sales, because that's not actually true. And it's also dependent on who they're selling to. You know, someone with a deeply technical offering might be also selling to other people that are quite technical. So that might actually work. I've been so surprised, like the last few years, having a team of BDs, business development people, as I do, it's the people that actually are really good at sales and not always the people that you think. So I've certainly had to sort of sit back, and it's not those typical qualities of an extrovert and someone who's, you know, terrible at data and never fills out the CRM, you know, all those sorts of things actually just make for a terrible salesperson. And I think we have grown out of that now. I think it's the way that we sell has changed. The people that we need to sell has changed. I think the only problem sometimes with technical people is that when they sell, they're so in love with the product that they often just talk about the product the whole time. And it's sort of like, I find it a lot. Like, let's say we meet with three founders a day, two out of the three will probably try and talk for half an hour about their product. And it's like, we don't have anything to do with product. Like, it's great, but really we're not deeply technical people. We're not here to actually assess the product. And we do say that at the beginning, and they'll still do it. And so I worry sometimes how those people will go when they're actually trying to sell it to others who just don't really need to get that much into detail. There is a bit of an assumption if you're down the line a little bit with a startup that the product works. So I don't need to know anything.
Yeah. And but capital flows from that, right? So making those not meeting your investors' sort of ideals as an early stage startup can really trip you up along the way. Yep. Like, really.
It can. And there's what's the saying? Read the room. It's like, I do get amazed that, and again, you know, there's so much out there for startups, for founders, in terms of learnings, and you can download so much information. Actually, there's just too much sometimes. It's hard to actually qualify which is the best. But, you know, there is a lot on pitching. There's a lot of, you know, you can download templates and things that do teach you how to present to investors and where to focus and what the flow should be. And they're quite simple and easy to follow. And yet, you know, we still have founders coming in and pitching product for half an hour. And I think that lack of awareness is probably the issue there. Like, you know, and I think taking on feedback and watching pitches on YouTube, there's heaps of them on there, really good ones and really ones they'll say these are the worst ones. I mean, look at those sorts of things and sort of use that as to educate yourself on how to speak to investors.
Yeah. And I guess the more pitches you do, the better you are in the end. Like, it's all it is practice. Yes. So honing those skills, honing the message, iterating. I mean, as the BD person, that's exactly what you want to see.
That's right. And it is that. And it's, you know, years ago, I used to think that some people were just naturally good at speaking and some people weren't. And I was not. So I was always in awe of people who were really good. And once I was at a dinner and this woman just stood up and talked about it. It was so concisely what she did, how she did it. And afterwards I went up to her and I said, how did you do that? Like, how do you speak like that? And she said, I've got a coach. And I ended up going to that coach, who was amazing. I had her for quite a while. And I just learned that it is practice. Like, you sometimes you just think you're not good at things. It is a matter of practicing and preparation. Practice, preparation. And if you're going in front of investors, you know, really asking for feedback too, and taking on that feedback every time and adjusting the pitch as you go.
And that is a great tidbit of advice, regardless of whether in the startup VC space or elsewhere. Because in reality, like the way that I think about my career, you are your best advocate. Mm. So if you can't articulate, you know, your strengths, your personal goals and ambitions, it's really hard for somebody else to buy into that themselves as well.
That's exactly right. And I think, like, I have a business coach who's unbelievable. I had a speech coach, you know, someone with that. And it doesn't mean you have to pay a fortune, but it just means, I mean, if you can't, I think putting the time in to educate yourself on that so you can actually pitch yourself, you can pitch your business. You know, in startups, you know, think about when you ask founders typically what they're looking for when they do early stage investments, they'll say that we look at the founder, we look at the team. And so if you think about that, what you're saying is exactly right. You have to be able to pitch yourself. You have to be able to understand your strengths enough to say, this is what I'm really great at. This is what I'm not. This is why I've got the team to do these things. All of that is sort of imperative when you're asking someone for capital.
Absolutely. So I mentioned that you ran your own business and you were overseas when you did that. Tell me a little bit about that journey.
The first one was in Australia, and it was a startup called Airworks. I wasn't the founder. I got in very early, probably a couple of months after they tried to launch it, and then ended up being CEO. And we had a very clear mandate by investors. They wanted us to grow it very quickly and sell it within 3 years, which we did. So we sort of got in there and scaled it from 2 people to 30 people and up to 0 to 20 million, and then sold it to a firm in Singapore. So we had that, which was really, really fun. Like, I look back and I think it was so crazy and so fun to build it, but probably at the time, very, very hard. But it was really.
And you were younger then.
I was, oh my God. I look back and I just, and actually I had a couple of my friends that worked for me. Because you know, you're growing so fast, you're trying to grab people and people I trusted. And I can't even ask them what I was like as a boss. I think I'd be too embarrassed about their response. But I think, and then I went to the US after that. So I was with a company called iCorp, which was owned by Channel 10. But it was a startup over in, it was a big startup here and a lead in the sort of the advertising area, outdoor advertising. And then we took the technology and everything over to the US. And so I had 3 years of doing that as well, which was a different set of challenges because we hit the GFC. I arrived in January 2007. And so it was very, and one of the things that was hard is trying to convince Channel 10 board back here that the GFC was happening, because it wasn't happening in Australia and we were over there.
No.
And I didn't have enough experience probably to realize, like, we were doing everything we knew how to do in BD and sales, and we just couldn't get any traction. And I remember for months, we couldn't work out why couldn't we close the deals? And then everything sort of started to come to light. And yeah, it was a pretty tough few years.
But that would have been a really exciting time to be on the ground in the US. I mean, really, like Lehman Brothers, Bear Stearns, everything,
Obama.
Sort of all the, all of that just all crashing down in a short period of time. I mean, looking back on that period, what are your big learnings?
It was a really an interesting time to be there. And as I said, like, Obama was, there was a lot of change. Politically and then obviously economically. The big thing I learned was that I always thought I was good at sales, but I realized I'd always sold in a very up market. So had everyone else my age.
So much easier.
And you just start to think you're really talented, and then you get over there and you're like, oh. So I learned that sales is a really big skill, and just because you can sell when there's a lot of demand and everyone wants to buy stuff does not mean that you're really good at it. And I suppose I've learned that, you know, even when I'm hiring people, you do need people who've sold well in down markets, because it takes a totally different skill set, a very disciplined approach, a very resilient approach. It's just super hard. And yeah, so definitely that's probably one of the big learnings, is that, you know, anyone can sell when times are good.
Yeah, absolutely. And do you think that everybody needs some sort of sales skills in their toolkit personally?
Look, I actually had a conversation with one of the wonderful people in my team, young people in my team yesterday about this. And I just was saying to her that I do. I think it's if you have the opportunity to grab it, because it gives you a different lens of the business you work. Once you're out in front of it, you see the marketing differently, you see the business differently, you're playing this critical role. It's a really obviously important role. It's also a very transferable set of skills. If you want to go and work overseas, if you're a good BD here, you can get BD work over there. So it's a good thing when you're young to do it. It's a really good fallback skill. And I do think it's critical. It changes, like I've worked, I'm sure you have, with people who haven't done BD, and I think you can see it in the way they approach marketing and sales. It's just not quite the same. And so I think being out there and having that pressure of hitting a target is really good. And it gives you a lot of empathy for other salespeople when you're leading people as well, when you've got a big team.
Yeah, absolutely. And I was talking to one of the portfolio managers I was working with yesterday, and I'm one of those people who goes, as a salesperson, your best asset is a portfolio manager who can also sell.
Yes.
Essentially in disguise. So, you know, as a technical specialist, as an analyst, whatever it is, if you can articulate your unique selling proposition, why you're great and why people should invest with you, that is so gold for a salesperson.
Absolutely. It absolutely is. And look, I think there's, you know, we've got portfolio managers as well. And it's funny, like one of ours who is the best, is amazing. She doesn't necessarily come from a sales background, but she's incredibly, you know, she doesn't come from traditional sales, but she's good at building relationships, but it can't just be relationships. I've got people that have worked for me before that have said, I'm so good at building relationships, but they can't sell. You know, they can have lunches and their people love them. But, you know, really for all of us, we've got to be able to move the dial in some ways. It's thinking about the impact you have. You can't have someone just managing a portfolio that's best friends with everyone. That's not impactful for anyone, actually. And so really being able to get in, and I think a lot of sales is, you know, people think that, you know, we touched on it before, that old way we used to see sales, like the extroverts and the people that talk a lot. It's actually the opposite, as you would know. It's the people that ask the right questions, get a deep understanding of the challenges that person and that business has, and then really thoughtfully thinking about what they've got in their toolkit that might be able to help with any of those challenges.
Yeah. And I approach every meeting like that anyway. So me personally, whether I'm meeting a startup as a potential investor or meeting a potential client, whatever it is not about what I can sell to you, but how can I help you in your current, you know, issue or complex issue state right now? And who can I introduce you to that can help alleviate those problems?
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. I think, and I think that's, you know, if you're doing that, as you say, that's exactly right. That's the way to sort of think about it, because there's a certain type of sales and marketing methodology we use called winning by design, and they talk a lot about impact. And I think we do the same thing. It's just thinking about, as I said before, what is the impact I can have? Like, how do I help you? And really just being slowing down, I think, and being really thoughtful when you're in those meetings around, you know, how you can help. And I think I say to my guys, like, having networks is so important. And I know the word networking is a bit cringy for most of us, but it's not, I'm just merely like being out there building networks. And look, there are very few people I've found are good actual connectors. Like, people can go, oh, you know, Amanda, you should meet blah, blah, blah. But the amount of connections I get for people, I don't know why people have connected me. I don't understand how I can help. Do you know what I mean? And so I think it's a real skill in slowing down and thinking about what is a valuable connection for both people and why, and articulating that in the email when you connect them. It's really good.
Yeah, totally. And I will say that my superpower is as a connector. That is my, and I love, love, love networking. I will happily walk into a room where I know no one and just go secretly, yes.
So how do you, okay, so I'll ask you a question then, because I find that really I'm very good in small groups, but in a big room, not knowing anyone, I find it so difficult. So how do you, when you walk in, how do you go and approach a group of people that you don't know? What do you do?
a big fat smile. It always starts. It's easy to go in with a welcoming smile, because particularly where you've got a group like of two or three and it's sort of closed off. My view is if you walk up to someone, you know, towards their shoulder or whatever, and smile and say, "Hi, my name's Camilla, you know, what's yours?" And then the next question isn't, "What do you do and who do you work for?" Because that kills me every time, because that's not who I am, you know. So maybe the question might be, "How was your weekend?" Or, "What did you learn from the conference today that we've been sitting at?" Or something like that, that opens up the conversation, that makes them understand that you are more interested in them rather than what they do. Like, I was talking to someone last night who went to a conference in the UK, and I've had this when I was in the US, so I'll be interested to hear your views. They're very like, they look at you, they look at your badge, and they go, "Oh, you're someone that I don't need to know right now, and you're not the person that I'm looking for. So therefore, you know, hi," and then they just scoot away, right? And that's just so mean.
And also short-sighted, because how do you know?
Totally.
How do you know that?
You don't
know. I always think that, like, how do you know that? Because, you know, they might, I'm not thinking about it this way, but they could be someone that could help you in the future with something else, in another job or something. I don't know. But it's funny you say that, because when I was in the US, my partner at the time was in film, he's a producer, and we used to go to these events, and I got so, because people would start the conversation with me thinking that I could help them, that I was in film, and as soon as they found out that I wasn't, they would literally just walk away. And they ditched me, and it was so humiliating that by the end of the last few years, I'd just say, "Hi, I'm Amanda, I'm not in film," and they'd go, "Okay, bye." And off they'd go. So it was, but yeah.
Oh my God.
It was pretty cutthroat, I would say. But, you know, I didn't want to waste their time, and obviously they didn't want to waste mine. But I think that's very short-sighted. And I also think, who knows what you'll learn from that person if you go in with that mindset. So I think that's a really good tip, though, that you're giving, because I'd say the majority of people find those sort of events really scary. And so maybe if we, more of us, go in with a sense of curiosity and a smile, we might do better.
Yeah, and if you are that person in the circle that person's coming up to, right, don't close the shoulder off, open the shoulder up, smile back and go, you know, put your hand out, shake and take it on from there. You know, ask interesting questions, listen properly, all that sort of stuff.
I always get scared because I'm tall. I think I feel like a lurch.
I'm the short person. So I'm probably coming in at like navel end, right? So normally it's like trying to get, you should try being at a bar, like being so short. It's like, oh my God, it's so bad, so bad. Anyway, going back onto the portfolio, so the venture portfolio, is there a company that stands out to you that you've helped along the way, and why? Because I love these stories.
Yeah, look, I like to think there's many of them that we've helped along the way. I think, you know, without sort of naming names, I'm just trying to think. I mean, definitely, actually. You know, the space that we love at the moment is the impact, climate tech. We do a lot and impact.
Yep.
And we love it. Our team loves it. And, you know, the KPMG people that work with us, that deliver all the work, do the tax, do the accounting, do the audits, they also love it. So, you know, we get companies, for example, like Great Wrap is one of ours, which is the potato skins to, you know, Glad Wrap. I mean, everyone was dying to work with those guys. Absolutely dying. And
love it.
And I think with companies like that, we actually, we put them all in our, when we got them as a client and we were doing some work with them, we have digital screens all around the offices, and we put them on the digital screens. People got so excited, and some of the senior partners were very, that own the relationships with like the Procter & Gamble's and some of the bigger clients, were really able to then go in and say, "Can we introduce you? How do we help you?" And we just loved.
That's excellent.
That was really, like, that's when you go, God, the model works. I think the model's working, that we can come in and really help. And I think on the other side, again, I won't, with this one, I won't mention the name, but we had a female founder with a really great startup in the impact, so climate space, really struggling to get funding. And we were doing a lot of the work around the finances and getting the financial models right. And so we knew she had the basics right, but she just couldn't seem to close with investors. And then we did what we call sort of impact modeling. So we're able to quantify the impact that she would have on her potential customers over 3 to 5 years. Mm-hmm. That meant she could go into investors with that information, and then she closed the capital. So closed the capital raise, and we were thrilled. And it just showed, I think sometimes those types of companies are going to have problems if they can't articulate or quantify that impact. Mm-hmm. And the ability that we are able to help them do that, I think that's awesome, especially with those types of companies.
Those stories fill my cup, because true, like my view is this space does true impact so much better than, say, for example, the listed space or anything like that.
Yeah.
And you know, I think as a global community can push us forward so much more in this space by doing stuff that has greater impact. So
absolutely
love it.
Yeah, so do we.
Love it. Love it. Is there something that keeps you up at night right now?
Yeah, there is. I mean, look, keep me up at night. I mean, I worry about this next 6 months, to be honest, of where the funding, I really hope that the sort of funding starts to pick up and we see more investment.
Again,
worry about climate tech as a space, because I think we're seeing a lot of companies who are struggling to commercialize, and it's like, you know, how do we help with that? And I think we've got to get better at that. You know, they've got to, the impact, focusing on impact is fantastic, but they have to get commercial. And so we're thinking a lot about how do we help founders, early stage founders, think about that earlier and really start sort of, as we said, getting out in market and sort of starting to see if there is product market fit for their solutions. And I think the last thing which is just making me angry is the proposed changes to the sophisticated investor.
We've had this come up a few times.
I just can't even. I did an interview for The Australian, I think last week or week before, anyway, where I was quite probably a bit too outspoken. But
nothing wrong with that.
I just feel really despondent. I don't really understand how this is. I'm sure there's reasons I don't understand why this is coming up, but I really don't understand why you would ever propose those changes. When you look at things like the UK, markets like the UK and the incentives they're giving to early stage investors, this would put us in the opposite direction. So why would that ever be proposed? And when I think about founders, and the reason I want to work with founders is because I'm not a founder. Well, I am a PhD, I suppose, but not in that sense. And I just admire them so much, and I just think it's every part of that journey is hard. And so if we can do anything to make it easier in any of the services, and that's the real motivation for us, we want to make it easier. So why would you ever think to make it harder for them to raise capital? And again, difference between SME and a startup is startups have to raise capital to grow. Obviously I've mentioned three. I could keep going because I don't sleep very well.
That's funny. So looking back at your career, is there a moment that sticks in your head that really was super impactful for you and the journey that you've taken?
A few, actually. I mean, I think probably, I mean, there's a lot of good things that have happened, but I think there was probably one thing that was the worst thing that happened that I think is important is when I was with iCorp, we had by the end of it, we didn't end on the best terms with management. I didn't. And one of the reasons was, I think this is important. So I don't think I read the room, I'd say, in a way. So I was, you know, in the role for 2.5 years. I was the SVP of business development ops and something else, I can't remember, innovation or something. But and I had got a lot of praise from the global CEO and a lot of the leadership team, and I kept going up and getting increases in pay and responsibility. And I just stopped listening to the CEO, and I sort of thought that my direction, I didn't check in that my direction was the same with my priorities were his priorities, or, you know, and we were connected. And I didn't hear him saying to me, we were going on different. I just didn't hear it. I think by then I was so, I'm going to keep going my way. I think I thought I knew better. And at the end of the day, the CEO is the CEO. And I was not in that role. And I didn't, I think I could have prevented what happened if I'd listened and not thought that, I think I just sort of went, well, it's sort of my business too, and I'm going to do it. And I've had more experience, and I felt that I'd had more experience than him. So I did that. And I think there was probably a bit of not listening, ego, and that came into play. And an inexperience on my part, really. But I suppose the lesson out of that was, you know, in all roles, make sure that your priorities are aligned with the leader of that business. And if they're not, get them aligned. If you can't get them aligned, it's up to you to go, because they're the leader. They're setting the priorities. Yeah. And I think it's really important that we support. You have to be behind the leader that you, that is, you know, that, that you, if you're working for someone, you're working for a CEO, you just have to be behind them. You know, in the in founder-led businesses, there isn't enough time or room for politics or arguing around that. And it's not that you don't have say, but generally you've got to be all walking and running in the one direction, I think.
Yeah, and I think that is absolutely good advice. And I think I have been there in those shoes as well, but I've realigned. So like when you make that rationalization and realization that you're like, okay, we're on two different pieces, two different ships. Mm-hmm. We all need to get back on the same ship. I realigned a few times, but then in the last year, I actually jumped off. That was something about, you know, changes in the business, changes in culture, changes in a whole bunch of bits and pieces. And it was time, like for me, it was time to go.
And that's right. I think that's exactly the right. Sometimes it just isn't, it's certainly too much culturally. That's really hard if you're going in different directions. That's sort of like a values and moral, like, you know, all of those things can start to feel compromised. And I think if you have the ability and to do so, then it is the right move is to part ways, I think.
Yeah, but we're still friends.
Yes, and it can be. And that's, you know what, that's the other thing. This can all be done well. And I think one thing I see all the time is this lost ability to debate. It doesn't have to be so you're on the right and I'm on left or whatever. You know, it can be a good debate, and you can walk out holding hands and being friends. You can agree to keep going forward together. You can agree to part, but it doesn't have to be all over, and it doesn't have to be all so black and white, which is, I just feel like you see, and I think social media is a really big part of that, this sort of you're that and I'm this. And I just don't think that's the way we are in the world. I think there's lots of crossovers with people that you never thought, you know, so I think we've sort of got to make an effort to find those a little more.
And you don't know when they're ever going to pop up again. Like,
that's right.
You know, 10 years down the track, they might end up being the chair of the, you know, of the board that you're CEO for, right? So you want to make sure that everyone's on the same page.
You do, but also, you just don't want to dread it, do you? Walking into something and thinking, oh God, they're going to be there. I don't want to go. What if they're at this event? And that feeling is, and you know they're feeling it too. It's horrible.
Yeah, it's not good. And that's, think about the energy that you actually expend in those feelings. Oh my God.
Not worth it.
So you've given us a lot of valuable advice today. So what, I'm going to flip that around. What is the most valuable advice that you've been given, and why was it important to you at the time?
Okay. Probably that, this is sort of like embarrassing, but a few years ago, my team, so I've always thought the best thing about me was the energy, and I've got all these ideas and I love iteration and I'm constantly improving. And I genuinely thought that's why people want to work for me. When people say, I was like, that's it. And then a couple of years ago, my team all got together. They pulled me in a room.
Oh no.
And they were really lovely.
Oh my God, it's a coming to Jesus moment, I think.
I feel like it was an intervention. I was like, have I been drinking too much? Oh my God. And probably. And they said, look, we love you, but you constantly have new ideas. We come to you with what you've asked for. And then as soon as you see it, you go, okay, let's do this and make it better. We can't sit with anything for long enough. And I suppose that I won't go into any more. I think you get the gist of it, but it was a real eye opener. And I think there was a few things that I learned out of that is I wasn't checking in with them. I wasn't getting feedback along the way. I was going, this is great. Yeah. They all love it. And they were probably sitting there and smiling. And again, I wasn't reading the
room. Oh, there's a theme here.
There is a theme here. I just get very excited about, I get very excited about things, very enthusiastic. And so what I learned from that was, you know, feedback's a great thing. Get regular, really, structure feedback. So you're getting that regularly, because sometimes you don't really want to ask for it, but if it's in a structure and you've got to get it, you'll get it. So that's great. And make sure you've got a safe environment where your team will give you, you know, the thing is I took out of that was, well, isn't that good? My team feels safe enough to have that conversation with me. Let's turn that into positive.
Well, yes. Yes.
But I also learned that, you know, that really made me think a lot. And then that's where I did get a coach, actually, because learning that everyone, it's easy to say everyone's so different, but they really are, and how they, the way that the work environment they need to be successful in and the way that they take in information, all these things are really, really different. And you can't cater for everyone, but you can find more of a middle ground. So my middle ground was, right, so we got a lot more structured. We agreed that if I set a direction, we would stick to it for 3 months. We would constantly, and we'd set everything up more as a hypothesis of testing things, but for a certain period of time, with clear things that we were testing, and I wasn't allowed to change anything until we got to the end of that 3 months and we check in. So we also developed a thing called the ice box, which I was to put all my ideas in and not speak about
it. Is it locked? It only opens on like the third Thursday of every month.
I don't even think they let me open it that often. But the thing I realized was that all my ideas weren't that great as I thought they were. I think that now when I put them down. And I look at them even sometimes 24 hours later, I'm like, oh my God. So now very few of them even come out because I don't want them to come out. So yeah, I think there was a lot to learn in that, but it was certainly just, you know, slowing down and really understanding the type of environment that you need to create for the team to be successful. So yeah, that was a big learning moment in all of that.
I think it's great, because what it also shows is, as a leader of teams and organizations, that you have a lot to learn from the people around you and supporting you. You can't necessarily be pushing down. You can't be the person on the pedestal espousing all the advice and the ideas. Actually, I think that organic bottom-up approach is really good.
I never think I know everything at all. I obviously make a lot of mistakes. That's not one of my key things. And it's funny, I've had challenges from younger people in my team who think the way, when I say I don't know things, that it challenges their idea of leadership, because they think leaders should know. So a few times they've said, well, I think if you're the leader, you should know. And I'm like, that's not my vision, my version of leadership. There is no way that one person knows everything. And this is not about me not making decisions. I make decisions. That's my role as the leader, is to make those decisions. But it's also to be pretty open about when I don't know things, and then seeking information to find that out. And often that information, people in the team know it, which is great. But we certainly don't know everything as leaders, and I wouldn't want to work with someone who thought they did.
And that's why you work in a team.
Exactly right.
There's no I in team.
Exactly right. Say it every day.
Yeah. Okay, so we're at the end of the episode, and we finish it always off with a quick fire round of a whole bunch of questions. Mm-hmm. And you have to say what you first thing that comes in the mind.
Okay.
Right? Okay, so you ready to go?
Yep.
We're already warmed up, so this is pretty funny. Okay. My friends would describe me as?
Energetic.
Great. Shares or shoes?
Shares.
My biggest investment mistake was?
Falling in love with the founder.
There's a story there.
Not literally.
Definitely a story. Not literally, but there's a story. Yeah. There's a story. The biggest lesson I've learned on the job is?
Biggest lesson. God, how many? Biggest lesson. To seek more data than I do before making decisions.
Great. My biggest, hairiest personal goal is?
I think the thing is for me is to travel more, definitely.
Great. Anywhere special?
No, I haven't done a huge amount of travel. I've got to say, the first sort of 15, 20 years, I just was really heads down. I just didn't really lift my head up a lot. And I feel like people are like, did you like Spain? I'm like, I haven't been to Spain. I don't know. So I've got a lot of catching up to do. So that is a really big
Spain's
goal.
Great.
Thank you.
You need to go.
I want to go.
You need to go. If I wasn't doing this job, I'd be a?
Working in a startup.
Great. What really crappy, embarrassing to admit movie do you absolutely love?
Pretty Woman's my favorite movie.
I don't think that's embarrassing to admit.
I think for some people are like, oh my God, I absolutely love it. I love the Pygmalion theme.
Totally. It's great. Autumn, winter, summer, or spring?
Spring.
What is the most important money lesson you've learned?
Don't spend it all. Save it.
Save more than you spend.
Save more than you spend. If I just followed that for the first 20 years, that would have been great.
Yeah, yeah. We would have paid off our house, both our
absolutely.
Houses.
Or you know what? Just get an investment property early. Why didn't anyone tell me to do that? I mean, I had the money. I just didn't want to take the risk. It seemed really hard and really scary to me. Now I look at it, I'm like, oh my goodness, that would have, it, you know, now I'd have a great little apartment somewhere. That would be awesome.
Great. Okay. Note to self.
Yeah.
And the last question is, describe in three words why venture cap is awesome.
Three words. Oh, because it's fun, it's fast, and you get to support lots of founders.
And it's furious.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, look, not in three words, but these the people that you're investing in are out there to make a huge difference in the world. And why wouldn't you want to work with those people and support them?
Totally. Absolutely. Well, Amanda, I've taken way too much of your time and so fun to hang out and have a chat. I've had an absolute giggle. So thank you very much for telling me how great you are at reading the room. And that's your advice pretty much for everybody to learn. Also the importance of business development and marketing and the story and the founder, you know, the founder's role in that. I think that's super, super important, not only as an investor, but also as a startup. And just really thank you for your openness and transparency. I love the story about your team. That is seriously gold.
I know. That's one of many. One of many.
But thank you for joining us on Shares Not Choose. Really appreciate it. And I look forward to seeing you soon.
Yeah, that was fun. Thank you very much.
You know, the information that is in this podcast, we always talk about finance in this podcast, but it's not financial advice. It's actually really careers advice. If you really want financial advice, I recommend that you speak to a financial planner or a broker and work out your own personal circumstances with that. But this is all about careers advice and how finance will be a fabulous career for you.